I'm Damien Grant, and this is Brent Norlin. Just a bit of a background for those of you who don't know us. Brent runs a company called Norlin Law, which is one of the most innovative insolvency firms around, as he likes to tell me. And I run the Waterstone Insolvency. Brent once headed up the Waterstone in-house legal team, and he's the second best lawyer who's ever left Waterstone, I have to say. But the best lawyer who ever left Waterstone actually now works for Norlin Law. Brent is making a little collection of former Waterstone staff members. You've got four now, is that right?
Yes, we're the Waterstone Gold class.
We're kind of Waterstone Silver. We won't talk about Waterstone Bronze. So what we want to talk about today is Mainzeal, because it's been a fairly topical case that's out there. There's been some reporting of it, but neither Brent or I really think that that the reporting has really reflected everything that's happened, and the case is up for appeal. So we thought we would cover that for you guys. So look, I'll kick off. We'll talk a little bit about the history of Mainzeal, because I think that's really important. Mainzeal's been around quite a long time, not as long as me, but longer than Brent. But in 1995, it was taken over by a guy called Richard Yan. Richard Yan is a Chinese gentleman who arrived in New Zealand on a Rhodes Scholarship and did really well and started working for Mainzeal. And over time, he ended up acquiring Mainzeal. And Richard Yan has investments in China, and he has investments in New Zealand, and Mainzeal was one of them. But relevant to this story, is around 2004, Richard Yan got some other people on the board of Mainzeal. At that point, Mainzeal was owned by another Richard Yan entity called Rechina. Mainzeal was then headed up by the new board, which included Dame Jenny Shipley and a couple of other gentlemen called Peter Gom and Clive Tilby, and Richard Yan was on the board. So that kicked off in around 2004. Dame Jenny Shipley, of course, was the former Prime Minister, although only for a short period of time. We then hit 2008, and that's when things really start to get interesting, because in 2008, Mainzeal was restructured. So, but from around 2004 up to 2008 and 2009, Richard Yan interests start taking money out of Mainzeal into Richard Yan interests in China, and they invested it in something called the Shanghai Leather Company, which probably doesn't sound that exciting, but apparently Shanghai Leather owns some really sweet real estate in and around Shanghai, and according to the judgment, the Yan interest made 140%, 140 times gain on it, upwards of $750 million.
Richard Yan didn't want to admit what that number was.
Like, no,
he was a little bit guarded about that.
So he would be one of New Zealand's richest men. which and even after this judgment, he would still be one of New Zealand's
richest men. Just drop in the ocean.
He can afford it. So what happens? Mainzeal continues to trade on, has some issues. Jenny Shipley was actually on the board. So the way they took the money out is initially they just ripped the money out of Mainzeal. Then they decided, okay, they set up another entity called MLG, which originally had Richard Yan, and Jenny Shipley was the director of MLG. Jenny Shipley left the board of MLG around 2007 or 8, I think. So Richard Yan was the director of MLG. MLG had nothing. All it had was the obligations to pay Mainzeal. New Zealand Limited Liability Company with nothing. Mainzeal, though, was still part of the wider Rechina group. And the directors of Mainzeal were of the belief that Richard Yan would continue to support this enterprise. And there was some reason for doing that. They provided support for bonds and other bits and pieces. Anyway, things started to get a little bit tough. In around April 2012, a new director comes on board, a guy called Sir Paul Collins. Obviously, Richard Yan likes his knights and dames.
It's a very good look from the public's perspective.
Oh, absolutely. You've got a knight on the board. Well, not you've got a knight and a dame.
Oh.
God, it's like Camelot.
How do we get one of these?
Well, there's probably one going cheap at the moment. So. But a bit tarnished around the edges.
Just wait a couple of years.
So the So then in late 2012, early 2013, this company, Mainzeal, on the balance sheet didn't look too bad, but it had $44 million that was owed to it by Rachina-related
On the
entities.
Balance sheet, it looked very good.
It looked very pretty,
yeah.
Yes. But the truth was that when Richard Yan turned around and said in early 2013, guys, I'm out calling the receivers were called in, BNZ got their money out, the liquidators were BDO, and BDO then had a look at this and says, we think we need to hold the directors to account, and how'd that go for them, Brent?
Yeah, pretty poorly. I mean, it's quite a disappointing failure for New Zealand. I mean, this company has been around since 1969. It's huge. You know, you've got a situation where subbies are owed $45 million.
Big loss.
Construction contracts, $43 million, and employees, $12 million, and general creditors, $9 million. So $110 million loss for New Zealand businesses. So, you know, 12 causes of action. So these liquidators literally threw the Companies Act at these guys. They spent millions and millions on legal fees.
Well, the media is reporting somewhere between 5 and 10 million. I think it's closer to the 10 than the 5.
Yeah.
That's a lot of money.
And of course, it's going to the Court of Appeal.
Excellent.
So there's going to be more. It's probably going to go to the Supreme Court too, because let's be fair, the stakes are high.
Well, also, Mainzeal built the Supreme Court.
They did.
So
they did. And
that's,
if they win,
that's nice.
And maybe if they win, they'll go to Sparkarino. They built that too. hey, look. 12 calls of action. They were only successful on one.
It's a bit disappointing, isn't it?
It is. So reckless trading. They claimed, their high water mark was $75 million. That they were seeking, and they got $36 million. $36 million seems to be really just a number plucked from the air based on intercompany loans to China.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to be, in my view, far too low. I think the judge really, really shot too low on this. $110 million, you've got conduct of directors that was appalling for years, you know, probably a decade.
So how would you, just if you go back and you have a look, let's leave Richard Yan out for a moment. So if you have a look at the anomaly independent directors of Jenny Shipley, Gom and Tilby, how would you assess their, so if you go back and you have a look, these guys come on board around 2004. At 2004, Mainzeal was part of a wider group, and there had been some bit of support going on. But there was also one-way cash really going from Mainzeal up to Rachina. So how should those directors in that situation have acted?
Yeah, so look, unambiguously what they should have done is they should have taken advice. And that was part of the criticism that they got is, so under the Companies Act, under Section 138, directors have a defence to breaching duties where they've obtained and relied on independent legal advice or from other professional advisors, senior employees.
But they got advice from Michael Harper, didn't they?
Oh, it was far too late.
It was late 2012?
Yeah, far too late.
6 months before liquidation?
It was very close. I mean, it might have been a month.
Okay.
I think it was a month.
So not
and his advice was sound. It was very sound, and so what Michael had told them to do, one of the had a list of things, but the highlight of it was go and document the legal arrangements between New Zealand and China, so Mainzeal and the parent, because there is no legally binding contract here, so Mainzeal is exposed.
And that was the guts of the judicial criticism, wasn't it?
It was. So, you know, they are in a situation where they're trading insolvently for years. Cash flow issues and balance sheet insolvency, really, because that was not collectible. Legal advice.
Narrow it down. So what was it that the judge found that they did that was reckless under Section 135, the reckless trading provision?
Yeah, so in terms of their recklessness, they had no commitments from China. That was an issue. And
well, they had commitments. I mean, they had letters of support.
Sorry, they had letters of support. And the auditors, the auditors had relied on that. So previously, PwC were the previous auditors.
They were let go.
They actually highlighted this as an issue.
Specifically, they highlighted
the issue with no legally binding contract.
Yeah. So it wasn't the lack of support; it was the fact that that lack of support was not legally enforceable.
That's right. Yeah, and as a result, they were subbed out. So PwC were. We're no longer required.
Hate it
when the auditors put a spotlight on an issue, and that really should have been a red flag for the board. I mean, you've got an auditor who's making recommendations who is then fired.
Will you come back to that for a sec? So, being fair for the directors for a second, one of the issues that the directors raised in this thing was that had they ended that thing around 2010, 2011, then the results would have been as Pierce said.
Yeah.
The CEO or the financial controller say would have been catastrophic.
Yeah.
So had they terminated that in 2010, then because a large part of the losses here was the fact that these construction contracts for which they projected to make money on suddenly became liability with all these liquidated damages. Mm. So part of the defense that the directors were running was say, hey, if we'd stopped this thing in 2010, it would have been a train wreck. All they did was kick the train wreck down the road by 3 years. So what was wrong with that?
Well, look, so the construction contract element of the creditors is $43 million in this liquidation. I don't know what it was at the time, but yeah, certainly the argument was that it would have been worse. And so I don't think the judge was suggesting that they liquidate at that time. And in fact, I think he encouraged them that would have been a bad idea, and the losses could have been worse. Because most reckless trading cases are quite simple, and it's you draw a line in the sand, and this is when you sort of should have stopped trading. And therefore, these are all the losses that you should be liable for after that point.
That's the Mason and Lewis case.
Yeah, and so this case is a little bit different. And so what the judge's main criticism was, hey, look, you've got a dame sitting here on the board. She has public status. People draw reliance on that. They were actually giving their financial statements to the developers and to induce them into contracts so they're profitable and it's a safe contractor.
And just stay with that point for a second. But the problem with that, though, was that on that balance sheet that they were handing out, they had all of these related party loans.
Yeah. And those parties could not have known that those
this,
were not
this would
collectible.
Be the third party. The people relying on that balance sheet couldn't have known.
No, they couldn't have.
Yeah.
And so what the judge had said was, hey, look, one of the main issues facing this company was the lack of legally binding support. So cash is flowing into China, but no real obligation of support coming back.
And see, because that's a real problem, isn't it? Because here you are, you're the director. In Dame Jenny's case, she's a former prime minister. Mm. She's been knighted. Here you have balance sheets. It's to be fair, I mean, it's kind of implied in the judgment that they did this. It's not explicitly clear that it happened. But here you've got this balance sheet going out there that looks pretty good, but Dame Jenny Shipley could have and should have known that those obligations were backed up by MLG, which was a shelf company with no assets. And part of the other problem was that those obligations were ultimately from MLG to Mainzel, MLG was owed the money out of China, and the evidence in the court case was they couldn't get the money out of China anyway. So the balance sheet that was being presented, if anybody relied on that, they potentially would have been deceived.
Yeah, and so really where the judge got to was, so he didn't suggest you should have stopped trading at this point. He said, you know, then Jenny Shipley, your threat of a resignation is a powerful tool. Mm. You could have said, because in 2010, right through 2010, she was complaining about this issue, and she was getting dismissal emails back, and then she would park it for a few more months. She could have used her status to say, unless we sort this out, I'm resigning. And had she done that, I mean, this could have ended very differently. I mean, they could have formalized those arrangements because that would have been catastrophic for the company. I mean, if she...
And particularly back in 2010, I mean, a lot of the things that brought this business down, including there was issues about a Siemens contract, which were difficult for them. There was issues about leaky home stuff in there. So maybe in 2010, had the board, including Dave Jenny, put their foot down, then maybe there would have been some binding commitments. Or alternatively, maybe the thing would have ended in 2010, but the creditors would have been no worse off.
Yeah, and because Mr. Yan, at that time, had confidence. So there were issues, but he had confidence. And so had she played that card, this could have turned out much differently. And then section 136.
Let's talk about 136. Section 136 is...
It's appalling. So the
so what's... Because it wasn't... Because I read that quote. I was quite surprised that the judge found them guilty on 135. So 135, to be clear, 135 is you're trading the company recklessly. And in this situation, the judge says, hey, look, if I go back and I have a look, you have all of these related party loans, and these related party loans are uncollectible. So on that basis, you continue to trade the company with a balance sheet that was completely unviable. So on that basis, we're saying that you traded the company recklessly. But on 136, 136 is different. 136 is you incur an obligation without a reasonable expectation that the company can afford to pay it. So I was quite surprised that the judge didn't ping them on 136. But you've got a slightly different take on it. So how do you view that decision?
Well, because my view is the judge couldn't have. The judge was not in a position to make a finding against these directors under section 136. So the problem with the way that the plaintiffs presented their case was...
The plaintiffs being the liquidators.
The liquidators. So the liquidators did a statement of claim that generically pled section 136. So they said that obligations were incurred and they didn't reasonably expect. There was no certainty over from what date these obligations were incurred that shouldn't have been. There was no specifics over what actually obligations are we talking about. And so as a result of the way they framed their claim, they did actually claim $75 million. So they said because of the breach of section 136, we should get $75 million.
So what you're saying is that, and to be fair, it seemed to be what the judge was saying, in order to claim 136, which says that you, as a director, allowed the company to incur an obligation without a reasonable expectation that the company would pay it, for that case to stick, the plaintiffs, the liquidators and their lawyers in this case, would have needed to have put to the board, hey, Mr. Gontorby, Yan and Shipley, here is a specific example of a creditor that you allowed the company to incur this specific obligation, and because and we're gonna ping you, and you're saying, and the judge seems to be saying, that the plaintiffs, the liquidators, didn't do that in this case.
Because a statement of claim is a framework for a proceeding. So you're saying, here are all the allegations that I'm level against you, and this is what you need to defend. And if you don't level the allegation in the statement of claim, you can't then have a decision because it's an ambush. So it gets worse, right? So statement of claim appears to be flawed, and certainly during the course of the litigation, they surely must have known that.
We can only go on what the judgment was.
But there was an indication that they were going to change their pleadings and update it, but then they decided not to. So I take that as implied that they did know, they made a decision not to. To be fair, they did have 12 other causes of action. I mean, they lost 11, but... So you get a situation...
It's like a cricket team where only one batsman makes a run.
So you get a situation where now the defendants look at the statement of claim and they run their defence. They get their advice based on that. They didn't bring in any evidence of the obligations, neither did the liquidators. So the actual contracts, the actual obligations were not in evidence for the judge to see. The directors were not cross-examined on any obligations. And these critical allegations were not put to the directors. And that's important because if you want to run a case and you want to succeed on it, which of course you do, you need to put all your allegations to the parties you want to find an onerous finding against. So in this case, the judge made a decision that he couldn't,
based on the evidence that was before him.
Yeah, based on the way that the liquidators ran their case, they couldn't make a finding under section 136.
So let's go back and have a look at that, because we'll come to the quantum of. of the 135 case in a second, but just looking at 136, it appears to me, reading the judgment, what the liquidators were saying was that you had breached your duties as a director, that the company was insolvent. You then says, all right, we're going to get Mainzeal to go and build this project. And so all of the creditors on that project were potentially victims of a 136 breach, where the director says, hey, we're going to go and we're going to build this thing, and all of the creditors on that now become exposed.
So, look, one, we have a gap in our knowledge because, you know, we're only relying on the decision. We don't have all of the evidence. But what you have here is a case where $110 million of creditors have not been paid. You have a long-standing issue where cash is flowing into China and there is no legally binding arrangement where that can come back or there's any parent company support. Where the directors are acting in the best interest of the parent company, not Mainzeal, and they've been authorized to do that.
Authorized, you mean under the
constitution? So yeah. There's a constitution that says you can act in the best interest of the parent and not the subsidiary.
And that's something that's specifically allowed for Companies Act as well.
It's allowed for. And so there's no real criticism of them of that.
But after the 2008 restructure, though, that was not necessarily the case.
Well, yeah, because that changed everything. But let's come back. All of these obligations that were incurred, you know, were probably incurred at a time they shouldn't have been, and that Mainzeal was unable to fulfill them because it had cash flow issues, it had the Siemens issue, Siemens wasn't paying, there was all these disputes. So they've got cash flow and they've got balance sheet insolvency. We don't know what the director's reasonable belief was about meeting those obligations because.
We kind of do, to be fair, because some of the emails and communications are in the judgment, and we see communications between Shipley and Yan, and the CFO was also raising those issues about the solvency thing. But let's maybe push out Mainzeal for a second and just think about that from a wider construction section, because there are other potential litigation issues out there at the moment with large construction firms. So you've got a situation where the company was insolvent. The company directors then say, okay, I'm now going to commit to building this railway station, whatever it is. If we ignore the Mainzeal case, which potentially can be worked around, from your perspective as an insolvency lawyer, could a liquidator in that situation hold the company directors liable for all of the losses on that specific project? Because to put that into context, so when you have a look at Quantum, right, for records trading under 135, the gold standard is Mason and Lewis. Mm. What Mason and Lewis says is, what are the liabilities of the company at the time of the breach?
Yeah.
What were the liabilities of the company at the time of liquidation? And it's that increase in liabilities from the time of the breach to liquidation, that's the liability, that's the starting point that the judge will use, which is a little bit different from the South Pacific case. We might come back to that. But the issue that was raised here, and what the liquidators tried to say was, particularly in 136, I thought was a really good argument, was we're not interested in that analysis. We want to say from the time that you undertook this project, all of those losses that occurred, you are liable for all of those losses that occurred on that project, even if there was a reduction in liability for other creditors elsewhere. So from an insolvency lawyer perspective, do you think that's an argument that could get home?
Yeah, I mean, under 136, I think there's flexibility there to talk about specific obligations that are incurred where there's no reasonable expectation of them being paid. But then there's also the possibility of a wider context where obligations are incurred in a wider context and can include just everything after a certain point, because if there's insolvency issues where a company cannot reasonably pay its debts, then you can draw a line in the sand and say, well, after this point you couldn't have paid any of your obligations. So if you can establish that starting point, then you can take a wider view.
So, because there's a couple of different criteria that the courts use here. So, in the South Pacific case, which was up until this case, I think the largest accredited judgment against directors, the second largest was Hansa, I'm pretty sure, which was one that Brent Norling argued on behalf of the Waterstone back in the day. But in the South Pacific case, you had a company director who was running his business in an enormously unorthodox and insolvent way, and the business relied entirely on the director's support. The director withdrew that support and the thing collapsed. The court there, and it went to the Court of Appeal, said the starting point is the entire losses of the company. He allowed some deduction because had the company been liquidated at the time the breach occurred, there would have been some losses anyway. But the starting point was the entire losses of the company.
Yeah.
The starting point in Mason and Lewis is the increase in losses. What the liquidators here tried to do in both the reckless trading case and the 136 was say, let's look at all of the new creditors that were increased. So it was rejected in 135.
Because the court does have an incredible amount of discretion when quantifying liability of directors. And I think, you know, just to go right back to the starting point, you establish a company to ring fence your risk. You want to be able to take risks. You want to be able to incur liabilities that are not going to be your liabilities, your personal liabilities. I mean, that's why we all incorporate. And so we can take those risks. But where directors start putting risks on the creditors, and it's not just risk, it's illegitimate risk. So they are no longer risking shareholder money, they're risking creditor money, then those directors put themselves at risk of the corporate veil being pierced and being personally liable. Here you have $110 million of losses. Subbies are almost half of it, you know, and this happens. This is the biggest one that I've seen, but this happens all the time. I mean, subbies do work and they don't get paid, and so you see these big failures, and then, you know, 12 to 24 months later, they're in your office. Well, they're in my office, then they're in your office. Or, you know, that's what happens. It is. I mean, it's just a domino. This is one big domino, and we've all seen. We've all seen subbies fail because of Main Deal, and I'm starting to have conversations with subbies about EBITs and other construction big construction companies. And so, you know, I think the courts in these cases need to send a really clear and strong message to directors that, hey, look, you can take risk. There's nothing wrong with taking risk, but where you take illegitimate risk, like they absolutely did here, then they're going to be personally liable for all of the losses from that point. And so, you know, part of the liquidator's claim here was that the point of insolvency and the point that the directors should be liable was about mid-2011.
And that was surprising. I was surprised that both that was the liquidator's claim. I thought the liquidators could have gone all the way back to the first time that money was repatriated to China. Particularly where you had one of the Mainzeal, where you had two Mainzeal directors, Yan and Shipley, who were also directors of MLG. And the evidence in the judgment is that MLG didn't have anything.
Yeah.
So, but it was to be fair to the directors, though, it was a sliding scale where this situation progressively got worse.
Yeah.
So, at least in the early days, Mainzeal was part of a wider conglomerate, and the directors could have had, I think, reasonable expectation of ongoing support. But as it continued, that degree of confidence ebbed away little bit by little bit. So there wasn't necessarily a tipping point. But nonetheless, the fact that those obligations were not legally enforceable and they were relying on letters of support that ultimately proved futile, I'm surprised that the point of insolvency was as late as it was. Mm. I thought they would have gone quite a bit earlier.
Well, I got the feeling from the decision that the judge would have been quite comfortable with drawing the line in the sand in January 2010. And arguably it was well before that,
yeah.
But he seemed very, very comfortable with January 2010. But the liquidators pled mid-2011, so you know, you get what you wish for in some of these cases. And the actual quantum, so $36 million. So Yan is liable for the full 36, and the others are jointly liable for six of that each.
But isn't that remarkable? Because on the evidence before the court, there was at a minimum $44 million of hard debt that went from Mainzel out to Richard Yan related interests. Yan provided letters of comfort that ultimately proved to be worthless, never honoured those agreements, and he is liable for less than the $44 million. That is remarkable to me. Mm. This is, here you have a somebody, there is no downside. I mean, we know there's no punitive element in a reckless trading claim, but at a very minimum, if you've taken $44 million out of your company, you make $750 potentially million in China on the back of it, you then allow that company to fail. How on earth did the judge turn around and find you liable for less than the amount of money that you took out of the company and chose not to repay? Well, that's incredible.
And the $6 million. So the $6 million for the others, right? So,
which is really zero.
So yeah, exactly. So effectively, the judge is saying, or the judge did say, that Richard Yan was in a conflict situation because, you know, he had interest in China and he wanted to get the money out and pursue it that way. Whereas the other directors didn't have that conflict of interest because they weren't financially gaining out the other side. I find that quite remarkable because I don't know what Dame Jenny Shipley was earning as a chairman of the board, but you know, it's going to be a very healthy six-figure sum.
As it should be.
And so,
I mean, she was trading on her credibility and her knighthood.
Yeah, and so that's not a criticism. Good on her. But of course, she had a conflict. I mean, she is incentivized to run this clock out as long as possible so she can keep cashing her check. I mean, everybody was gaining financially off the back of Mainzel at the board level. I mean, it's not clear in the decision because they don't talk about it. But there's no way she sat on this board of a very risky company that, you know, she knew. She was asking questions in January 2010.
And she was getting woeful answers.
Yeah, but she was asking the right questions. But she was getting the wrong answers, and she'd walk away.
She was so close.
So why does she do that? I mean, her incentive must have been financially just to.
Let's not impugn the motives of the former prime minister.
No, but
because we know there's all good and honest people.
But they shouldn't have got $6 million. I mean, it's quite laughable.
Well, it is, because that's about 5% of the losses of the creditors. So here you have. Tilby Gom and Shipley were directly liable because they controlled the board. Yan was only one. I mean, Yan could have fired them, but they controlled the board and they allowed this behaviour to continue. So how it is that these guys are only liable for 5% of the loss of the company is absolutely beyond me.
Yeah.
The judge on that, he doesn't really fully articulate either on the Mason and Lewis analysis, nor even on the South Pacific analysis, how he gets a judgment that's so woefully low. And that sends an incredibly perverse incentive, because if you're in that situation, the liability, I mean, this is an incredibly large insolvency. Most insolvencies are far less than this. So it doesn't really provide any disincentive. And the fact that it was, that liability was shared with Yan, so it was $36 million. If Yan pays his 36, then the other three directors are off the hook entirely, which seems madness.
Yeah. I mean, let's talk about the recovery.
Yeah, I was about to say. So what do you understand about how this has been funded?
Yeah, I mean, so word on the street is it's got litigation funding. I
heard that too.
Good bunch of
guys.
Yeah, so I have no idea what the contract says, but probably somewhere between 30-40%.
Well, no, it's been reported in the media at 30%.
30%. Okay, so 30% of any net recovery is going to the litigation funders here, right?
And just to be fair, that's not a criticism of litigation funders, because they have spent somewhere between $5 and $10 million getting this there. And if you have a look at that judgment, 12 causes of action, only one got home.
Yep.
And the one that got home was not a slam dunk. Because in that judgment, the judge made the comment that had he been convinced that the directors could have relied on the support from Regina and Yan interests, he wouldn't have even given them that. So litigation funders put somewhere between $5 and $10 million at stake, and they could have lost a lot. So 30% recovery is not is why I think it's cheap.
Yeah. Look, so I've got no criticism of the litigation funders either. So you have a situation. I mean, litigation needs to be funded. You've got lawyers. So yeah, $5-10 million is going to go to Court of Appeal, probably Supreme Court.
Expert witnesses.
This is going to be well north of $10 million. And you have a big, large group of well-respected QCs and law firms in the mix and experts. It's not cheap. And so the actual net recovery for the creditors, once you pay the legal fees, once the liquidators take their very reasonable liquidator fees.
Liquidator fees are always reasonable, Brent.
Are they? Are they really? I mean, I have the benefit of being on the other side of liquidators quite frequently on this particular issue. But that's all I'll say. And so, the liquidators will take their fees, and then after their wash up, there's going to be very little left for the creditors. So when you have $110 million, let's assume if the 36 stays is 36, there's going to be less than 10 cents in every dollar for these.
Well, creditors. I mean, my understanding is that the liquidators are currently sitting on about $4 million from their statutory reports. So let's say that they get net another $10 million off this judgment. That's about 13% roughly, which actually isn't, I mean, it sounds terrible from a layperson, but from an insolvency perspective, that's actually not a bad result. But it comes back, I think we're both on the same page, that the $36 million was woefully inadequate given the behaviour of the directors in this case.
Yeah.
I think the one of the things that the plaintiffs, the liquidators, argued here, and it was a new approach. So we spoke before about the Mason and Lewis case. What was the debts at the time of liquidation? What was the debts at the breach? And you had the South Pacific case. The starting position is you're liable for the lot, and we might give you some discount for various factors. But in this situation, the liquidators ran a quite innovative argument that hasn't been run before, and they said, at the time of the breach, any creditor who saw their position either worsen from whatever it was to wherever it ended up, they wanted to see the directors held liable for that creditor, and they were not prepared to grant any deduction for creditors who saw their position decrease. So what they were saying was, if you were not owed any money by Mainzeal, the directors of Mainzeal breached their duties, you then come along and supply to Mainzeal whatever your losses were at the date of liquidation, the directors should be liable for that. And the judge kicked that to touch.
Yeah, and in the specifically the 136 cause of action, that was up to $75 million. So the liquidators had quantified on a new debt approach $75 million, but it doesn't appear that they, because they didn't plead it, because they didn't get the evidence in, they didn't cross-examine on it properly, that the judge was not able to make that finding. But new debt approach.
What about the reckless trading case?
What was it? I can't recall the reckless trading actually.
The judge, I don't think he really gave an adequate explanation as to why he rejected the new debt approach. I just think he didn't like it. He preferred to take, and he actually made the comment that it was he wasn't going to get sucked down to some false precision number. So he came out with 36, which was about a third of the total losses of the creditors. He linked that to the $44 million of the related party debt. He also made some reference to the amount of capital that he thought that potentially should have been injected into the company at an earlier point to stabilise it. So the judge kind of didn't really give he wasn't necessarily obligated to. The liquidator says, hey, how about this approach? And the judge says, well, no, I'm going to stay with some standard analysis. But I think it's maybe disappointing that wasn't explored under 136, because if you have a look at the way 136 is structured, that a company director cannot incur an obligation without reasonable expectation that the company can meet that obligation, then the new debt approach under 1-3-6 is potentially a really powerful one. And the good thing about BDO is that they also have the EBIT liquidation, so maybe they can attempt that particular cause of action in EBIT. Did you hear that, Ian?
How'd they get EBIT? Another story. Okay. Yeah. So we talk about key takeouts.
Sure. You go first. You're the lawyer.
Me first. Okay. So, you know, key takeout for me, for directors, is if you're in a situation, you need to take legal advice. You need to take, in some cases it's going to be accounting, in some cases it's going to be legal, but you need to take expert advice. So there is a defense to these causes of actions that liquidators can take, and that is if you obtain advice and you reasonably rely on that. So if it's from expert advisors or senior employees, and you act in good faith and you make reasonable inquiries on that advice, if the circumstances require it, then there can be no finding against you for any reckless trading or negligence incurring obligations. And so had they obtained advice earlier, that advice surely would have been exactly what Michael Arthur eventually gave in the month prior to. You know, that would have been the same. He would have said exactly the same thing. They could have solved the substantial problem facing this company if they got that advice early. And if they got that advice and they couldn't solve the problem, they could have resigned from the board, they could have made a decision, because that was a powerful tool that they always had. They could have resigned from the board and walked away from this liability and avoided this possible train wreck. So, you know, for directors in these situations, advice is going to be crucial. And you know, there's a massive problem in the construction industry. And, you know, subbies are usually the ones that pick up the bill. And, you know, the Construction Contracts Act was designed to create efficiencies and to create more certainty, you know, and on a grassroots level, day to day, it's these big players like Mainzeal that use the act really, really effectively. You know, they're getting paid big chunks
and
in
not
advance,
paying, not paying the subbies for
and not
60
paying
days.
Subbies, yeah,
and that's how Mainzeal was getting their working capital.
It was.
Well, see, I mean, I have a slightly different take out, and that I look at Mainzeal and I see this is an exceptional result, because the number of times that liquidators actually take litigation action is almost never.
And why is that?
There's around 2,000 to 3,000 liquidations a year in New Zealand. There is typically only between 6 and 10 actual judgments against directors. Why is that? I couldn't possibly speculate, Brent. But there's typically only been
There's usually only 3 liquidator names that appear on those judgments, though, isn't there?
And David Levin is no longer taking appointments, so it kind of, you know, reduces it down slightly. But the entrance of BDO into the field of aggressive liquidators is fantastic, and I'm really pleased to see BDO now join Waterstone as potentially one of the only 2 insolvency firms that actually goes out there and takes this litigation. Although, to be fair, McDonald Bay did get a judgment against the company director last year, and I'm sure that will work out well for them. But the key takeout here from my perspective is that the risks of reckless trading for almost all directors is zero, because the vast majority of, and if you can choose your own liquidator, and he's one of these kind of Horatio Nelson ones that wears an eye patch, the chances of getting pinged is incredibly low. And even if you are pinged, you're not going to get pinged for the full extent of the losses that you are responsible for. And so in Yan's case, he sucked out $44 million worth of Mainzeal, according to the judgment, put it into China and made as much as $750 million. He was incredibly unlucky to get pinged, and he was pinged for far less than the economic wealth. So the brutal reality, the key takeout here is that there is almost never any negative consequences for reckless trading, and that's a deep disappointment.
You know, I've
and hats off, to be fair, to both BDO for taking this claim and for litigation funders for for putting their money where their mouth is and funding this thing, because they took a huge risk.
Well, because that's a big issue, right? Because I see cases all the time now where the High Court is taking a proportionality approach to litigation, and in particular against liquidators. So they're saying...
Well, sometimes against me in particular.
Yeah, and, you know, I had the pleasure of arguing that particular one. So... you know, but you see it where the court's saying how much are the creditors owed, what are the liquidators' fees, and if they're not proportionate, then liquidators get pinged. And in cases where liquidators are taking the risk, they're not spending creditor money to pursue a delinquent director. The delinquent director puts the liquidator to a whole bunch of unnecessary work because they are non-compliant with all of their statutory obligations. And because of that, liquidator fees go up, and then the courts paying the liquidators for having too high fees. So it's just contributing to a reluctance of liquidators to litigate for fear of, hey, if this case actually takes a few turns and we get to some crossroads and it's messy, it's not a straight line.
And it takes turns because the company directors are being obstructive.
They're obstructive.
Anyway, we're probably getting onto some of our own little hobby horses here. So we're probably taking enough of the viewers' time. It'd be interesting how many have actually got to this point of the video or audio.
I know there'll be two.
Okay. We won't talk about them. And I think that's a wrap from us. Thanks for watching, those who got to the end, and we will be back with more of these in the future.